Of course, you've heard of dyslexia, but how about dyscalculia, a difficulty juggling numbers? This hour, math and the brain, the connection between your skill at arithmetic and your fingers, your digits, and why Amazonian villagers with no math training can solve basic geometry problems just as well as you can. Could we be born primed to understand some math problems? Plus, can microbes create the weather? Specks of dust or soot floating in the clouds can attract ice to form around them, building hail. But microbes can do it also. How airborne bacteria hitch rides in hailstones and make it back to Earth alive. And science diction, the history of syphilis, not a medical term, but the creation of a poet from Fair Verona. Stay with us. Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit gotomeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE.
Thank you, Anna. And now, on to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This spring, thunderstorms, tornadoes brought not only deadly winds and rain, but intense hailstorms. I actually got caught up in one myself this week. And you know, as you watch these giant chunks of ice pelt everything in sight, it can't help but marvel at how all of this ice gets formed in the sky. And you know what? It's a lot more complex and fascinating than what we all learn in Earth science class, as my next guest will tell you. He's been collecting hailstones, literally picking them up off the ground. He stashes them in his freezer and then dissects them in his laboratory, piercing together and piecing together the journey that they've made through clouds by looking at their layers of ice. And he's poking into their cores, too, and looking for the essence of their beginnings. And apart from the usual dust grains in the nucleus of the hail, he's found lots of other stuff, like pollen and spores and even living bacteria nestled inside the ice. Yes, bacteria, lots and lots of bacteria in ice from all over the world, even in ice in Antarctica. What do bacteria have to do with hail and ice? That's what we're going to be talking about first. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave a note there. Let me introduce my guest. Alex Michaud is the PhD student in ecology and environmental science at Montana State University in Bozeman. Alex joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here.
Hi. How did you decide, give me, to go around picking up hailstones?
Well, it was kind of a sample of opportunity, a chance occurrence. There was a very large hailstorm that fell on Bozeman in June of last summer, and watching him hit the ground with some significant force was very interesting. And so I went out after the storm was, right after the storm was over, and decided to pick some up and put them in the freezer and see if I couldn't look at them in some more depth.
And how do you dissect a hailstone, and what do you find inside?
Usually, the method that I used was to cross-section them, so cut a thin slice through them, and that allows you to reveal the layers. And then from there, just dissecting with a razor blade, you can cut the different layers out and then analyze from there.
And you found bacteria in the center of the hailstones that you can culture?
Yes. So that means that they are live or in some sort of state that allows them to persist through that ice.
And then what's fascinating is that in reading of your work is how it appears how common bacteria is at the center of hailstones.
It is. There seems to be a fair amount of them, you know, on the order of ones that are alive and can be cultured, about 1,000 per milliliter of sample water that you get from the middle of a hailstone.
And so what's the advantage to, if I'm a bacterium, what's the advantage to me of hanging out on the inside of a hailstone?
Well, they need a way to get back down to the surface. It's a pretty harsh environment up there in the clouds, lots of UV, cold, dry, not the best place for a living thing to be. And so it's good to be brought back down to where you have protection in the soil or on a plant surface, much more suitable habitats. And so whether they come down in hail or rain, it's a good thing to get back down to the surface.
Interesting. And there are certain bacteria that really have an affinity for creating these ice. We know that ice sometimes needs a little drop of something to form around, needs a nucleus, right?
Exactly. You need something to initiate the freezing of water. Everybody thinks, you know, water hits 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit and it freezes, but it needs something to freeze onto. And so normally water has to cool well below that if it's pure water in order to freeze. And bacteria actually do it really well at warm temperatures, or more so than bacteria, but also biological particles really help to start that ice crystal formation at warm temperatures, mm-hmm. say minus 2 degrees Celsius to minus 8 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm. So when these bacteria get to the ground, if they can form ice at a warmer temperature than let's say left alone other particles of soot or whatever in the atmosphere, and they land on leaves, aren't they going to start getting ice into the plants themselves?
Yeah, that's what's been studied for the past 40 years. Is these bacteria as plant pathogens, because they don't allow the water in the plants to super cool and cool down to the point of not freezing. So these bacteria cause frost injury in plants, and if you disrupt a plant cell, it's going to leak out a bunch of good nutrients and food for you to eat.
So this is a way of getting inside the plant and then freezing at a higher temperature, and sort of like water in pavement breaks open the pavement, water in the leaf breaks open the leaf structure so that the bacteria now has some lunch inside there.
Exactly. And that's a very common, or it's a common strategy for a select few of bacteria.
Mm. And if there's a lot of these bacteria floating up in the atmosphere and making it easier for it to rain or for it to hail, would that not affect the weather? Would they not be, have some sort of influence in the weather?
Yeah, some past studies have shown that there are about 40% of the nuclei, or the initiators of drops of precipitation, are biological in origin. Now, that's not saying just bacteria, but other types of biological particles do help begin the process of precipitation. And so, yeah, biology does play a role in this precipitation process.
Do you think that perhaps certain bacteria evolved to be able to form ice crystals around them?
Yes, that's a debate right now in the literature, you know, whether or not these bacteria were evolved to cause frost injury in plants, or is this a mechanism for getting back down to the ground once they've been swept up into the air by strong winds. So, yeah, it's one of the big questions that we're asking right now.
Here's a tweet that came in from Noah Court, who says, does regular unfrozen precipitation have bacteria too?
In the form of rain?
Yes.
Yes. That's what Brent Christner and others have been studying. You do have live bacteria that do cause unfrozen precipitation, such as rain.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do now that you've got all these hailstones? What's your next line of inquiry here?
Well, because hail is really good because it's a kind of record of the storm, and so continuing to analyze those embryos or the cores, very middle of the hailstone, to show that there are these efficient ice nucleation active bacteria at the core, this allows us to link a function with a bacteria to show that they were present at the site of nucleation.
Well, good luck to you, Alex.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
No problem.
Alex Michaud is a PhD student in ecology and environmental science at Montana State University in Bozeman. Next up, mind your mind over math. A couple of interesting mathematics stories this week. First, it's obvious that a lot of mathematics is just learning rules, right? How do you find the least common denominator? Why you can't divide by zero? But there are some parts of math that just feel intuitive, like geometry. At least sometimes it feels that way to me. And now a new study suggests that even without mathematical training, the human brain may have certain intuitions about geometry, concepts that we don't learn but may be born primed to understand. We maybe have this hardwired right into our brains. The study showed that Amazonian villagers with no formal math training seem to understand these geometric concepts as well as we do, as well as we folks who go to school and study mathematics. Véronique Isard is a research scientist at the French National Center for Scientific Research and Paris Descartes University in France, and she's the author of that geometry study in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and she joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Isard.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yes. Welcome. Tell us about this study. What sorts of questions were you asking the indigenous people in the Amazon?
Oh, yes. So it's a study. I have to say that I didn't do alone, of course. I'm working with a linguist here in CNRS, Pierre Pica, and he goes to the Amazon every year to study these people, the Munduruku. And so this year we were interested in how they understand geometry. And particularly we were interested in how they understand concepts of geometry that is not things that we can perceive, that go beyond what we can perceive, such as the idea of an infinite line or idea of lines that would never cross, lines that are parallels. And so the way we ask them questions about this kind of concepts is we ask them to imagine some ideal worlds. We ask them to imagine a world where people lived, which was just, for example, very flat and going on forever and ever. And then we would say that on this world there would be villages, and the villages correspond to what we geometry-educated people think of as points. And then we would say that on this world, there will also be paths, with the constraint that all the paths are just going very straight and always in front of them, and that they would never end. Mm-hmm. And of course, for us, this path corresponds to what we think of as straight lines.
We're going to stick with us, Dr. Izzard, because we're going to take a short break and talk about the results of your studies and how these folks who lived in the Amazon were able to have a concept of geometry as much as we folks who study the math in schools. Stay with us. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Don't go away. We'll be right back. To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town, or on the other side of the country, or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance, or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code SCIENCE. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SCIENCE. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about math this segment with Véronique Isard, research scientist at the French National Center for Scientific Research 1-800-999-8255. Dr. Rizal was telling us about this group of folks in the Amazon who had no experience in mathematics, right? They had never seen any math, yet they were able to have, they sort of have an innate ability to understand geometry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure we would call it innate, but I would say it's a universal ability to understand geometry, because we don't know how people come to understand geometry. Is it innate, or is it something they learn early in life? And that's something that is still up for research. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we got them to imagine these imaginary words and ask them questions, where we found that they are able to conceive the fact that there would be straight lines that are infinite, that never end, that two lines may sometimes never cross. So they have, for example, an understanding of lines being can be parallel.
And did they get this ability at a certain point in their lives, at a certain age? Did they need some sort of maturity or experience to understand the concepts of geometry?
So in the Amazon, we only tested adults and children of age 7 and more than that. And then we also tested groups of adults and children in the U.S. and in France to compare them with. But we also tested a fifth group, which were young children in the U.S., children aged 5 and 6 in the U.S. And we were interested in them, of course, because at that age, they haven't had education in geometry yet. Mm-hmm. And we actually found that these young children in the U.S. were not doing quite as well as the Amazonians or as the older children in the U.S. and in France. So that actually tells us that if this ability is innate, actually it would be something that comes later in life, that if you can think, for example, of the beard is something that is innate but appears only in puberty, and maybe geometry is just like that, that it appears only by age 7.
Interesting.
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
Of course, there is another possibility, which would be that geometry is something that we learn before the age of 7. So maybe around 5 and 6, children are actually on the way to learning geometry and grasping these concepts.
Interesting.
That's another possibility.
Interesting. It's a very fertile area of research. For those of us still struggling with simple numbers, my next guest has been investigating a condition known as dyscalculia. It's a difficulty doing arithmetic where some people have a tough time grasping the meaning of really simple numbers and how the numbers interact with each other. Brian Butterworth is an emeritus professor of cognitive neuropsychology at the University College London. He's also former chair of the Center for Educational Neuroscience, and he has an article in Science this week on dyscalculia. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Butterworth.
Good evening.
How would you define that? How much of a problem is it with just simple numbers? Can you give us an example?
Sure. One of the standard tests for dyscalculia now is just to say how many dots there are in an array, like 3 dots or 7 dots or 9 dots. And dyscalculics are bad on that test. I mean, they're slower and they're less accurate. So the problem isn't just being bad at long division or multiplication tables. It seems to be a much more profound difference between dyscalculics and normally developing individuals.
Can people add simple numbers like 5 and 2 and 7 and 12 or something like that?
Sure, if they get enough practice. But they'll do it in a different way, and they'll do it rather slowly. So they might, for example, use their fingers, where typically developing adults would not use their fingers. They'd just know that 5 and 7 is 12. But the dyscalculics will go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then another 5, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So they'd be slow, and they might use a different strategy.
I see a lot of people doing that. Can this be an undiagnosed problem in the population?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's very widely diagnosed. On our best estimates, at least 5% of people suffer from this condition. And there have been studies in the US, in Israel, in Cuba, in many places, which suggest that the prevalence rate is at least 5%. So that means that a lot of kids who are bad at maths, indeed adults who are bad at maths because they have this condition. And the trouble is that if you've got this condition and it's not diagnosed, people think that because you can't do arithmetic, because you can't add 9 and 7, you must be stupid. And so teachers think that kids who can't do this are stupid. Parents who think their kids can't do this think they're stupid. And the kids themselves think they're stupid. And then their classmates think they're stupid. So it really is a problem if it's undiagnosed. And unfortunately, not many educational authorities actually recognize this as a serious problem. But actually, it is a serious problem. It's a serious problem for individuals, because individuals with low numeracy are much more likely to be unemployed. If they are employed, they'll earn less. At least in studies in the UK, they're also likely to be more depressed, more likely to be in trouble with the law. And so the outlook for individuals is extremely problematic. But also, the outlook for the non-dyscalculic taxpayer is bad too, because in the UK, where they've done the sums on this, they reckon it costs £2.4 billion a year in lost revenues, in problems with justice, in additional teaching. And so it's very expensive for the rest of us.
Let me go to the phones to Kent in Dallas. Hi, Kent.
Hello.
Hi there. You sent us a note on our Facebook page that you have dyscalculia.
Yes,
can you describe,
I do. I've lived with it all my life.
Describe for us the problems you face and how do you overcome it?
Well, a lot of the strategies that he mentioned are what I use. I'll count by fives. I use calculators. I use my kids because both of them are better than I am at it. When I was younger, it was very frustrating because I would have, you know, high science scores, high language scores, and then math was just like this black hole. And so we would do a lot of individual studies. My parents worked with me very hard. They were actually key in getting me as far as I got.
Hmm. Interesting. So you've learned the little techniques to get around it and get help from other people.
Yeah.
Did your teachers understand your problem at all?
Some did, some didn't. It was kind of hit or miss. I mean, the ones who knew me, that knew that I was really applying myself. You know, I had a trig test one time. I studied. I got a 9 out of 100. I studied to retake it. I doubled my score. You know, I did end up passing the class, but it was because the teacher knew what I was. She knew the thought process that was going on, what I was trying to do.
Well, thanks for sharing your experience with us, Kent. And good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. 1-800-989-8255. Veronica, do the Mundurucu people have a number system counting, stuff like that?
Well, they have a very special number system. They actually have number words only up to five, which is something that is quite common in the Amazon, but so that's how we got interested in them, because we also first did studies of their numeracy, and we looked at how they could perceive numbers even though they had this limited lexicon, and we actually found that if you show them images with lots of dots, you ask them to compare where there would be more dots or less dots, they're still able to do that. Mm-hmm. So even without a linguistic system, you still have an intuition of numerical quantity.
Why don't they have larger numbers? Do they not have to keep track of larger items, numbers of items?
Well, it's a hard question to answer, because of course if you don't have a large number system, then you're not going to keep track of large numbers of items. But I think it would probably be of some use to them. But they have also developed alternative systems, like they would use configurations, for example, for keeping track of numbers. They would put five on the side, five on another side, and then they might complete the picture with even more fives or things like that. So for example, when they do a basket, at first they have to make sure that they have enough lines to make the basket, and to make sure that they do, what they do is use some geometric configuration where they make squares of 3x3 lines, and then they make big squares of smaller square of 3x3, and then once the configuration is complete, they know they have the exact number they need. Mm-hmm. So I think they develop this on-the-spot strategy to track this precise number that they need in precise situations, but they don't have this abstract system that we have to track any number of anything.
Very interesting. And Brian, is there any crossover between...
Well, I think there is, actually, yeah. Because in previous work, Vale and Meek and her team have found that the Mundaruku are not very good at doing exact calculation. I mean, they have to go through these elaborate strategies, but they are very good at geometry, which they've never been taught. So that suggests that in evolutionary terms, geometry and numbers are separate. And also we know from studies of brain function and structure that the part of the brain that deals with space and geometry is not exactly the same as the part that deals with numbers. And it turns out, actually, that quite a lot of people who have dyscalculia, that is, they're really bad at arithmetic and numbers, can be actually quite good at geometry. So it seems to me that there's a convergence between the work that Veronique is doing in the Amazon and the work that we're doing with normal children in a numerate society actually converges to a certain extent.
1-800-989-8255. What about, you know, we call it dyscalculia. There's a dys, like in a dyslexia. Is there any connection between the two?
Well, that's an interesting question. They're both developmental disorders. They both seem to run in families. They both have particular neural signatures. But as far as we can tell, the neural basis of the two conditions is really quite different. So there aren't overlaps in the brain between the reading brain and the calculating brain, at least broadly speaking. Also, as far as we know, the genetics of dyscalculia and the genetics of dyslexia are different. So they seem to be independent. On the other hand, what happens in, as a matter of fact, is that you're much more likely to be dyscalculic if you're dyslexic, and much more likely to be dyslexic if you're dyscalculic than you might expect by chance. Hmm. So there's a kind of mysterious co-occurrence of these two developmental disorders. We don't know why that should be, but it does seem to be the case.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow, talking about mathematics and the mind this hour. 1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about it. Let's see if we can get one more phone call in. Paula in Wisconsin. Hi, Paula.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call. I am almost 60 years old, and listening to your program is the first time I've known there was a name for what's been wrong with me.
Really?
I struggled as a child. I'm adopted, and my father was an accountant. And it drove him crazy that I could not do numbers. And to this day, of course, I still can't. And my friends know that when we're, like, going to play a game of cribbage, they have to add it for me. I can't keep more than, like, two numbers together in my head at one time. They just don't go there. And I do have to use tools to count, either my hands and I have to add weird, like if somebody wants me to get, you know, subtract 7 from 23, first I bring the 23 down to a 20, and then I could take 7 from that, and then I got 3 more to get rid of, and, you know, I've just over these years learned.
Wow. What do you say to that, Dr. Butterworth?
Well, it's not the first time I've heard a story like this. We've tested a series of what we call high-functioning dyscalculics. These are people who of high intelligence who've been very successful in life in all sorts of different areas, including science, by the way, but who nevertheless have this profound problem with numbers. So whatever they've tried to do, they haven't managed to succeed in doing simple arithmetic. Now, one of the problems here is that we think we have a way of helping them, but these adults didn't have the opportunity to use that method when they were growing up, and we still don't really know whether our methods are going to work in the long term.
What myth? Can you briefly tell us what that is?
Well, you have to work with concrete materials for much longer with dyscalculics than you would with normal people. That is, you have to get them to use beads and blocks and so on until they really understand what fiveness is and what happens when you add a set of five objects to a set of three objects to get eight objects. So you've really got to make sure that they understand those processes before you start giving them 5 plus 3 or the number bonds to 10 or the multiplication table. You've really got to make sure that they understand these concepts in either in real concrete materials or what we've been developing recently are virtual concrete materials where you have software, computer games, which simulate or emulate what a good teacher would do with concrete materials. This, we think, really does help these kids. Whether they'll ever get to be normally good calculators, we don't know yet, because we haven't been running the study for long enough, so we'd need to be running that for some years now.
Wow.
So I'm sorry, your caller didn't have the benefit of these methods by your family.
I think my caller is going to alert to a lot of other people listening and other people around the the world who never knew what they had. And thank you very much, Dr. Butterworth, for letting us know. And good luck to
you. You're welcome.
Brian Butterworth is former chair of the Center for Educational Neuroscience. And also with us was Veronique Izard, research scientist at the French National Center for Scientific Research and Paris Descartes University in France. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the history of syphilis. Stay with us. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Of course, that means it's time for this month's episode of Science Diction, where we explore the origin of scientific words. And this month, we have a special extended edition because not only does the word syphilis have an interesting history rooted in the Italian Renaissance, but the origins of the disease are pretty mysterious themselves. No one really agrees where it came from, when the first cases were reported or appeared, and the condition itself is fascinating to physicians because it's caused by a very evasive, tricky little creature. We promise not to gross you out. Dr. Howard Markell is professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He's also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Welcome back, Howard.
Good afternoon, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Peter Leone is a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He's also chair-elect of the National Coalition of STD Directors. He's also on the phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Good to have you back. Howard, tell us how the term syphilis came about. Where does it come from?
Well, it really was a beloved literary character that was created by an eminent physician, poet, and professor named Hermonymus Fracastorius, and he did this in 1530 when he wrote an epic poem called Syphilis Sive Morbus Gallicus, or also known as Syphilis or the French Disease. And he wrote a poem about this mythical shepherd named Syphilis who rejected and then insulted the sun god, and in response, the deity struck him down with the dreaded malady, and that's where the name comes from.
Wow. And Dr. Leone, can you walk us through the various stages of infection when you get syphilis?
Well, syphilis is an interesting organism because or disease because it mimics many other diseases. So there are three stages to infection. The first stage occurs about 1 to 3 weeks after someone may be exposed to and infected with syphilis. It may take actually up to 3 months before we actually see signs. And a person develops what we call primary syphilis. They get a sore or a lesion at the site of inoculation. That's called a chancre. Usually doesn't hurt, although some of the pictures of it, you would think it hurts quite a bit. Because it doesn't hurt, many folks either don't recognize it, don't see it because it depends on the location, or treat, and of course it clears and goes away. Untreated, you haven't gotten rid of syphilis, you just get past the first stage, and then they go into what we call the second stage or secondary syphilis. That's where the organism breaks out of the local area, spreads throughout the body. Usually there's low-grade fever with that, a rash, can get swollen lymph nodes, people may get what we call patchy alopecia, and inflammation of organs like the liver and kidney. Again, untreated, that stage goes away, and then they enter into a long latent period in which the organism really doesn't turn over much but can cause long-term disease before about 15% of folks go on to what we call tertiary syphilis or this third stage of syphilis that can lead to things like aortic aneurysm and CNS disease, so dementia and nerve damage, as well as what we don't see much of anymore, gummatous disease, which are lesions involving bone and soft tissue.
It sounds awful, but I guess the good news is that it's easily curable if you catch it.
It is. I mean, we've had effective therapy for syphilis for 60 years. It's penicillin. We don't see resistance to penicillin, but we haven't been able to eliminate this organism in the U.S. or internationally.
Dr. Mark Hill, in the early days of testing penicillin, American doctors deliberately infected hundreds of Guatemalans with syphilis, something that just recently came to light, did it not?
It recently came to light. A historian named Susan Reverby at Wellesley College was the one who uncovered that. She was looking at papers of a man named John Cutler, who was the physician in charge of that. He later became associated with another infamous syphilis study, the Tuskegee study. But in this experiment that was done between 1946 and 1948, there were 700 Guatemalans, prison inmates, soldiers, and mental patients who were deliberately inoculated with syphilis. Shocking under any circumstances to a 21st century observer, but especially so because of the years, because 1946 is also the year when penicillin is widely available. And so it's on so many levels unethical and problematic, and that only makes it more so. And so when this was uncovered October last fall, a very different thing happened with this response to, say, Tuskegee or earlier scandals, is that the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and then President Obama immediately apologized on behalf of the United States for such a study, and the President ordered a full commission investigation by the National Bioethics Commission, the Presidential Commission on Bioethics, which should report out their findings. They had a charge of 9 months, and they started in January of this year, so we should expect something from a lot more fully about this in September.
Do we know, Howard, where syphilis originated?
One of the great questions of the history of medicine. And you could separate the world of historians of medicine into two fronts. Those who believe Christopher Columbus and his band of sailors went to Hispaniola, the Dominican Republic in Haiti today, where they not only discovered but probably raped and pillaged and brought back that infection of syphilis with them from the New World to the Old World. Now, there's some interesting chronology because right a few years after that voyage, it starts breaking out in places like Italy and Spain and all across Europe and France and so on. And a lot of you can trace a lot of people to the Columbian travels discovery. And the syphilis they were seeing back then were incredibly acute and abrupt and gross and deadly in a very short period of time, in quite distinction to the modern stage definition that was just discussed. And so these people developed serious skin lesions that were very gross to look at, as well as had rather rapid death. And so this was the pandemic, if you will, of certainly Fracastorius' time, but all throughout the Renaissance.
Dr. Leone, where do you come out on this one?
Well, I'm Italian-American, so that's my disclaimer, and I certainly don't blame the Italians.
But I think there's actually pretty compelling evidence now that this was a quote-unquote new world disease that was brought back to the old world, although it's interesting that there's some debate whether or not the organisms that eventually led to T. pallidum, which is the organism that causes syphilis, may have predated in East Africa, and with the slave trade went to Asia and then from Asia back to North America, where over time we wound up having T. pallidum develop and syphilis. So, you know, we're all interconnected. It just took a lot longer for things to get transmitted from continent to continent back then.
What I find interesting is there's some research just out this week and in recent days showing an outbreak of syphilis among seniors, you know, the baby boomers.
Well, we continue to see outbreaks in the U.S. In fact, we hit an historic low in 2000. The CDC had rolled out a syphilis elimination plan in 1999. I'm the medical director for HIV and STD in the state of North Carolina. We were involved with that plan. We hit an all-time low in about 2002. But the rates have come back up in the U.S., and so we've seen increases in older Americans, and in particular among men who have sex with men. In 2008 to 2009 in North Carolina, we had a doubling of our cases of syphilis. About half of the new cases in men were also HIV co-infected. Through a lot of efforts here, we've seen about a 20% decrease in those numbers, and we continue to see decreases this year. But it's a concern in that this is an organism that's very tricky, and we continue to see transmission and outbreaks even in the U.S.
Howard, do you think that the disease is different today than it was in the past, maybe less virulent, even though it's showing its ugly head again now?
Yeah, well, it's always remained its ugliness and its virulence. But I think if you're using these, and they're narrative descriptions. We don't have blood tests or DNA evidence or anything we would use, whereas my old pathology professor would always say, get the tissue before you make the diagnosis. But it sounds like these original cases in the late 1490s and all throughout the 1500s, particularly the early years, were more severe or abrupt. And could it have been caused by a different organism or a combination of organisms? We just don't know. And that's right. The other part of that syphilis equation in terms of Columbus is the pre-Columbian theory, that it was not, you know, a new disease at all. So, you know, there's just so many mysteries about this disease, past and present and future.
And how did the people back then, how did they deal with syphilis back in the Renaissance, the days before antibiotics?
Well, you know, you always round up the usual suspects in Renaissance medicine. Bleeding is a big one. But also anything else that could change what were construed as the problem with the four humors. So they might do some cupping, which is using these hot cups to draw out negative humors. They might have given you emetics or purgatives, but the treatment was, you know, limited at best, and people who got sick generally died. But, you know, up until the 1940s, in the United States, say in 1939, 64,000 Americans died of syphilis. So it was a serious disease that killed a lot of people well up to the middle of the 20th century.
And Dr. Leone, why doesn't our immune system just detect the bacteria?
Well,
get rid of it.
Yeah, there is some debate whether or not there may be some partial immunity that may protect an individual from acquiring syphilis shortly after acquisition. And if you look at the trends in the U.S., there's about a 10-year cycle where the numbers go up and then they come down, and it's pretty consistent in terms of these 10-year periodicity. The belief is that there may be some basically low-level herd immunity, but people can get reinfected. And the reason for that is the organism itself has a lipid outer layer of fatty acid covering most of the protein, so that when it actually presents to the immune system, there's not very many proteins that the body can respond to. And as a result, we don't get protective antibodies to syphilis, and we don't clear it. And then the organism likes to hide out in immune protective sites like the central nervous system. So a lot of the long-term diseases that we see related to untreated syphilis are because those sites are somewhat protected from an immune response. So it's a tricky organism. It's been smart. We don't have a vaccine for it. But we still have effective therapies. And, you know, the big debate is why do we continue to see it in the U.S.?
And what would your guess be? Why, if it's people just don't know to look for it, maybe.
Well,
they don't know. They don't think they could get it, or it's, you know, we don't talk about it very much. Because if you can just simply get a penicillin shot and get rid of it, you'd think that people would say, okay, I'll just go get one.
Well, you would think, but we don't do a good job talking about sex or sexuality in the U.S. So when you add a disease like syphilis that has a pretty horrid history associated with it and a lot of stigma, people don't necessarily walk into their doctors and say, hey, I think I have syphilis. In addition to...
Right, let me just interrupt for a second and say, are doctors looking for it?
No, and that's the problem, is that not only aren't physicians presenting or patients presenting, but physicians aren't even thinking about it. And because the signs and symptoms could be mistaken for other infections and diseases, they may not test for it. So we are really trying to raise awareness, and I'm actually glad you're doing this program today, because our syphilis numbers in the U.S. have gone up. And in particular, this is a problem because of the association of syphilis with HIV.
Yeah, you did mention those statistics being higher. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. You know, in some diseases, in viruses sometimes, there's a reservoir that may hang out in the birds. You know, we heard of or swine flu or avian flu, things like this. Does syphilis infect other animals where it may incubate and attack us?
No.
Is that right?
No. So this is a human disease, which is why we can talk about elimination, which really, again, comes back to the question you raised, Ira, about why aren't we getting rid of it. And I think it's because when we're dealing with syphilis, we've taken a medical approach to it. Our idea has been that we should just be able to test and treat. That assumes everyone has equal access to care, which we know isn't true. That assumes that clinicians think about it and will treat when they first see signs and symptoms, which is not true. But we also ignore the fact that the reason it persists has to do with all the what we call contextual factors that allow folks to actually engage in activities that put them at risk and also create economic situations in which they may not have health care.
We're talking about syphilis this hour. I'm Ira Flatow. And this is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I'm just flabbergasted to hear these statistics that this is, you know, not being talked about. It's on the rise. It's easy to get rid of once you have it, but yet it's persistent. And we need to talk about it some more, I guess.
I think we do need to talk about it. It's funny that we've had, I think, two conversations in the past month, one about herpes and one about syphilis. We need more dialogue, and I think we're trying to, again, raise awareness about this. But also the communities that are impacted have been so marginalized, whether we're talking about men who have sex with men or minority communities. I mean, Tuskegee still plays a big shadow on the land around our efforts to try to eliminate this disease. And, of course, internationally, there are issues around access to care.
Mm-hmm.
So I think until we begin to deal with the underlying issues there, we can kind of keep a lid on the numbers. I mean, our numbers in the U.S. are a lot lower than what they were post-World War II, and we're averaging about 13 or 14,000 cases of infectious syphilis a year right now. But it is alarming that it's going up.
Well, Howard, you know, some pretty famous people died from complications from syphilis. Maybe if we started saying if these people die from it, you might also.
Well, that's one approach. You know, it's ironic, though, we're talking about we don't talk enough about it. In 1934, Franklin Roosevelt's Surgeon General, Thomas Perrin, was set to go on CBS and talk about syphilis. And they would not allow him to say that word on the radio in that era. So there's all sorts of discomfort that we have in our past and present about talking about it. But you're right, there's lots of famous people. You know, Scott Joplin, the ragtime king, died of it, Al Capone, Toulouse-Lautrec. Probably the most notorious was Guy de Maupassant, the great French writer and, I would say, derelict, who not only contracted syphilis but said, at last, I have the real thing, and then went on to have sex with six prostitutes in front of his friends. So lots of very irreverent behavior among some of the famous victims of this terrible disease.
Oh, maybe we can end and go and come full circle at the beginning. Can you read a little bit of that poem to us?
Absolutely. It's such a wonderful poem. But here's the part where the real action happens. The all-seeing sun no longer could sustain these practices, but with enraged disdain darts forth such pestilential, malignant beams as shed infection on air, earth, and streams. From whence this malady its birth received, and first the offending syphilis was grieved, who raised forbidden altars on the hill, and victims' blood with impious hands did spill. He first wore buboes, dreadful to the sight, first felt strange pains, and sleepless, passed the night. From him, the malady received its name.
Wow. All right. Well, I think we've given it a little bit of sunlight today.
Or the sun god may have done that. I'm not sure. I'm going to respect him.
All right. Thank you, doctors. Howard Markel, professor of the history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. And Peter Leone is professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, chair-elect of the National Coalition of STD Directors. Have a good holiday weekend. Thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Ira.
Have a nice weekend, Ira.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.